Hey everybody, so this is Andrew, and what do you want to talk about this week, Wolf?
Node.js and events versus threads.
Yeah, I saw your notes on that. It looks complicated.
Yeah. I have a lot to say about it, but right. Hopefully less than I actually have on the notes, actually, but go on.
Okay. So take it away.
Okay. I thought, did you have some follow-up, or do you want to do that at the...
I have enough notes that that's basically going to be my topic, so...
Okay, there we go. So an accidental tech podcast, number 97, the last one, since we're recording this on Thursday. The title of it is You Have to Know When to Ship. I was surprised to hear that Marco was talking about Node.js, which he's pretty famously a PHP and Objective-C guy, and to pick up, Node.js to basically for his use of Overcast. Was interesting to me to kind of get that beginner's mind kind of looking to how other people deal with Node, because I've been using Node for quite a very long period of time, for a few years now. And one thing that he mentioned that was really amazing about Node that I also was very impressed by is really when you launch things like Python or Ruby from the command line, it's just you can't is or God help you if you're actually launching Java apps from the command line. You know, there's a tick. It's a beat of time before your program actually executes. And it doesn't seem to matter whether you're on SSC or whatever. And that does not seem to be the case with Node programs, that when you type Node and whatever foo.js, it is remarkably fast to get started. In fact, I jumped to Node from Java Web Objects, and that was one of the big sells to me. It sounds like it's one of these things where it sounds immaterial, right? Because like, how many times do you restart your app, right? But it's like measuring like buying a family sedan based on 0 to 60 times. Yeah, it's nice, but really it shouldn't actually have four doors and enough seats for everyone. But it does make a difference. And another thing about it is that it's not just, and it, it makes sense because the V8 JavaScript engine that is part of Node is built for web pages, and obviously when you land on a page, you want to be able to start executing the JavaScript as fast as possible, because that's a real performance advantage, and that's just the type of thing that Google likes to micro-optimize on. And and it's pretty cool to actually have those kind of crazy optimizations accessible to you in server-side apps. And another thing that I mentioned is that he couldn't believe how fast it executed. He had like some sort of feed crawler going in PHP, and apparently was having some scalability issues there. I'm not a PHP guy. I don't know what the real issues were, and whether PHP is fundamentally unable to do that type of stuff. I suspect it can, because Facebook seems to be doing pretty amazing scaling stuff with PHP. Granted, they have their own like VMs now, and I think they compile essentially transpile PHP to C++ nowadays, which is kind of crazy. But they're my point is that optimizations seem to like they're there, but maybe this requires really getting involved in it to actually tap those. But he mentioned how he basically threw I think it was what was it 200,000 or 400,000 feeds or something at it that he had to crawl, and how fast was his process run, how this tore through them. And that's my experience with Node as well, because remember, Node is basically Ryan Dahl's crazy no malloc HTTP parser wrapped around nowadays it's libuv, which is their eventing kind of a library there, that's kind of bolted to V8. So it's like these very highly optimized pieces kind of bolted together, and they work pretty well together until you get to the point where what Marco ran into, which is something that I was actually surprised he ran into, that he talked about how his feed crawler basically stopped at 1.6 gigabytes of allocation. Apparently that is limited in Node.js about how much memory you can actually allocate. And this actually raised some doorbells, some alarm bells for me. Maybe doorbells as well. I don't know. There's probably some sort of joke I could make there. That I have to agree with Syracuse that it sounds like some sort of streaming problem where not a sort of streaming, but a windowing problem where he's like trying to buffer things. And one of the things with Node, and one of the things that's kind of a double-edged sword, is that it's is very minimalistic in that it offers asynchronous APIs that, and they've actually, was an effort, I think this pretty much is complete by now, to actually strip synchronous APIs. So when you go to read a file, like I think they might have even taken the synchronous version of those APIs out of there. So you always have to specify a callback. And so it's the kind of like convenience abilities that you like, oh, I just want to read a file. Why do I have to specify a freaking callback for this? I mean, this seems like, you know, this, you know, more code that I won't want to throw at the problem. If you want to have, you know, high level, very nice looking code that's slow, you can be using Java Ruby. If you want to do things in kind of a way that is invented, that is all synchronous, and so your program has to get work done while you wait for very slow, even SSD to load up that data, then, you know, Node is a thing for you. So his issue was that he hit this memory wall. And so I think there's some sort of buffering going on. I did see a tweet right before we started recording here that looks like it might have something to do with a memory leak, with him having to do, or using the set timeout to do kind of polling, time-based polling action on these feeds. I wouldn't be surprised if that is an issue. I have not run into this myself. I have been running Node in production for a long time, and I have had leaks, but they haven't been memory leaks. They've actually been file descriptor leaks. So, you know, it's not, and that was also an old version of Node that I've never bothered upgrading, and so this auto restarts on me, and I'm like, okay, whatever. But I will also point out that I think he's probably talking to a MySQL database for storing his feeds. I think seem to remember that he has a preference for MySQL. And Node MySQL, which is the Node module that for interfacing Node to MySQL, is actually very interesting enough. I mentioned how Node really wants to be async and call kind of callback-based type stuff. Node is also really huge on streaming, and Marco made a reference to it, about how you can do like MD5 calculations while the data's going through, so you don't actually have to like load it all into memory. Thus, to do a checksum on it, you actually can do it piecemeal as the data parts fly by. You don't have to keep it all in memory or write it to disk or anything like that. That Node MySQL actually supports streaming the query result rows itself. And which is pretty nice. So you don't have to wait for, if you ask for something, in this case, I think Marco was probably basically doing a select all on his 200,000 feeds and gain 200,000 rows back. You don't actually have to put all those 200,000 rows in memory at once and then start working on them piecemeal. Is that you actually can say, hey, call me, we call this callback for each row as it comes in. And furthermore, even much more nicely, is that even plays with Node 0.10. Actually introduces a new kind of way to deal with kind of Unixy pipes inside of JavaScript, where you can like take the output of one set of object operations and kind of feed as input to others. And this was a bit of a hullabaloo for the 0.10 milestone, but it's working now. And I know I had to wait for it. I think they started like a 0.8 for this, and so it's very nice because it basically the type of stuff where you have to kind of manually, because when you think about it, MySQL is probably going to feed you those 200,000 results pretty quickly. That's what it's optimized to do. So it's probably faster than, I almost guarantee it's going to be faster than what Marco's HTTP fetcher could then go ahead and fetch each URL. Those results are going to come much faster than you could do a HTTP request on each one of those. So you have an issue here where the result set that you're dealing with is actually going to be coming much faster than what you can actually deal with it. And this is exactly what the new Node Streams 2 mechanism is designed to deal with. That actually exerts back pressure on the pipes so that you don't, so it will handle all this type of pausing of the query results flooding into your Node process in a way that's standardized. And it turns out that the Node MySQL module actually even supports that. And the it's called the high watermark. And so in this case, Marco could have said limit to 1,000 or 100 or something like that. Actually, a lower number might be better because those would be probably represent how many concurrent HTTP requests are in flight. Some 100, you know, 128, something like that, might be actually a good number for that type of stuff. So this all led into, he also kind of mentioned that invented stuff seems to be, you know, the way of the future. This is how we are all building things, all that. And actually, it's quite the way of the past. And so there's this great blog by Adrian Kohler called The Morning Paper. And he is in, the elevator pitch for it is an interesting, influential, important paper from the world of computer science every weekday morning. And I'll link to it. And it's a really great read. And fortunately for me that he had a series of five blog postings on kind of threads versus events type stuff. And so his first one is, not his first one, but for our purposes of our conversation, his first one is why threads are a bad idea, and is referencing to a John Osterhout presentation from 1995 about basically going through the list of things we already know why threads are bad, and we've talked about this before. Specifically for all this, all these details right here, episode 65 of Edge Cases, threads are interesting. I go into a lot of detail about this type of stuff. So if you're interested in it, I recommend going back and listening to that episode. Anyway, so the type of things that we know that threads are bad at is kind of, you know, all the problems are enumerated there. So, but as to act as a counteracting force to the why threads are a bad idea posting, the next day he did why events are a bad idea. So that's the thing that you think is going to save you. Turns out to not save you. So it turns out threads are a bad idea and events are a bad idea. And it turns out it's this paper, which is interesting enough, written by Rob Van Baron, Jeremy Condit, and Eric Brewer. Eric Brewer of Cap Theorem fame. And which we talked about it in episode 95 of Edge Cases, Conflict-Free Replicated Data Types. And so I won't go into the details here because I'm trying to keep this episode fairly short. I'm already running kind of long. But and I've already mentioned kind of I went in a little bit more detail in episode 65, so you can go there. But is this definitely one of these things where if you think events are getting you know, free and clear of this problem, it is one of these things where it's out of the frying pan into the fire type problem, that events have their unique trade-offs. And as a matter of fact, one of the papers that was in these series of five postings was on the duality of operating system structures, which basically makes the case that there's that event-based systems and threading-based systems are duals of each other, that one can always be expressed in terms of the other. And so there's kind of like this Jekyll and Hyde type thing going on. Problem is that I don't forget which one the monster, Jekyll and Hyde. I think it's Hyde, but they're basically both Hyde, that they're both going to bite you. And the issues that are kind of dealt with at a higher level with the thread abstractions are the same issues you're probably going to have to deal with in invented systems more explicitly. Now, this might be kind of a NoSQL type thing where you actually want to kind of get your hands on these specific problems because maybe they don't apply to your problem domain. But in general, you're going to have to solve these anyway. And so to me, events have kind of taken primacy in our current generation of server software. And I think it's more of an artifact of our poor tooling that we have to make these things explicit because our language tools and our runtime tools are not up to the task. And I wanted to kind of hedge that a little bit, that actually they are up to the task, theoretically and academically, that in that paper about why events are a bad idea, they actually, one of the main problems with threads is that how much space they take up, like stack-wise and stuff like that, how inefficient they are. But if you look, they actually wrote a little bit of a better compiler to deal with C's kind of primitive nature. And they were able to support, you know, 10,000 threads at one time because they could add a little bit more efficiency. See, that people weren't so interested in making threads efficient. They were interested in just getting them to work at all. And so if you actually just turn your attention to a little bit of efficiency there, you actually can make threads work just as well as events. And finally, I want to point out that a couple of the other very interesting blog postings in the series is a language-based approach to unifying events and threads, which is kind of uses Haskell in a way to kind of mix event-based programming and thread-based programming in a way that use threads for what they're good at, use events for what they're good at simultaneously. And this, interesting enough, is kind of like the Pulsar's model that I wrote for Red Hat Threads that allowed one straight line code path to span multiple callback contexts, be it IO bound or or CPU bound. And that, of course, was in C++. And the final paper in the series was Scala Actors, Unifying Thread-Based and Event-Based Programming. And that ended up, there's basically a language dedicated to this stuff now, so it's a little bit outdated, called ACCA. I've actually never heard it pronounced out loud, so I'm presuming that's how they pronounce it. And it uses actors, which I think, I forget which episode I mentioned before, but I'm a big fan of actors. And, you know, if I could wave my magic wand and kind of move the industry toward anything, I'm leaning towards the actors right now, because it seems like it's a good fit for kind of a concurrency model for something that plays very well with the object model we currently have today. Yeah, that's it.
Okay, let's see here. So just to verify this for me, you were surprised with Marco that he hit the 1.6 gigabyte limit?
Yeah, he's definitely he's hitting some sort of memory leak there, or he's buffering more than he should. Like, I mean, I'm not, okay. It'd be one thing if you're loading a million rows maybe, and those rows are fat with data, maybe you could hit the gigabyte limit, but something strikes me that something was leaking there, maybe not of his own doing, but something was not going right, because the entire idea with the streaming type stuff is that you shouldn't actually have that much memory in flight at any one time.
Even for 200,000?
Even for 200,000.
Feeds, yeah. Okay. And then, okay. Well, I guess we can quote for that. There's one note at the end of your notes, which it sounds like you don't necessarily want to get to.
You know, I'll just throw it in there. I will say cooperative multitasking has gotten short shrift. This is the problem of you being able to actually see my notes. Yes, cooperative multitasking is actually a really nice programming model in terms of it buys you a lot of the efficiency that Marco saw switching from PHP to going to a single instance Linode or whatever he's using. You know, he saw that he used much less memory, much less CPU, and getting much more work done. And it's really, event-based systems are good at leveraging the factor that, callback-based systems like Node are good for leveraging the fact that CPUs are fast and I/O is slow. That fits today's bottleneck very well. Mm-hmm. And so, the big problem with preemptive threading is that the concurrency issues makes even simple things very tricky to deal with.
Right.
So you don't do concurrency. What you do is that you just put in the choke points right where they match the problem points. Anyway, go ahead.
But then you never, right. So, but like your brain can't fit all of the things that can go wrong when you use threads. So you try to simplify it enough to make it work. But then you miss stuff because it's so complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have not read any of these papers. I am barely following most of what you're saying. But I have one thing that I can add, and that's probably why goaded you to say that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that paper that I wrote for Mac Hack?
Yeah, it was called Leopard's Pelt something.
Weaving the Leopard's Pelt. I thought I was being so clever. Because there's a Microsoft thing called a fiber.
Yeah.
That was basically, the way it seemed like it was being described, was a cooperative multitasking thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I wound up using this because I was attempting to port an old IF interpreter to OS X, where the old quote-unquote cross-platform code base that assumed you could always have a single main path of operation, because it was used to working on Windows, where it was the same thing as the old Mac OS 9 approach, where you called out to handle events, whereas on OS 10, you let the OS handle the event and call you back. And so I wound up using something that was like a Microsoft fiber, like a cooperative thread, to make that work on OS 10.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm pretty sure I've mentioned it before. I'll put another link to the show notes to it. But it is sort of funny that because I was using such an ill-fitting cross-platform code base, I actually found a need for this sort of thing. And it was so nice because I really didn't have to worry about memory stomping in any way, shape, or form, because I knew I was stopping my thread before the OS got to it, before anybody else got to it. So.
Mm-hmm.
It can definitely simplify things.
Yeah.
Okay. So my topic, I guess, is basically follow up, which is that I want to talk a little bit about the Overcast, the stuff that we've been having to do with for Overcast recently.
This episode is all Marco all the time, huh?
It really is. That's funny. Oh, that's a good title too. So you might have seen, if you follow our Twitter account, the Edge Cases Show Twitter account, we said, what, like yesterday, a couple days ago, for users of Overcast, type or paste in this as a workaround for a properly working Edge Cases feed. And we gave you a URL, which is edgecasesshow.com/RSS_overcast.xml.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our normal feed is just that same URL, except just RSS.xml.
Yeah.
And that is what you get if you search for Edge Cases and you choose our podcast, because there's actually another show called Edge Cases out there.
Oh, okay.
It's like for lawyers, I think, something like that.
Oh, wow, okay.
If you search on that within... or they'll sue us.
Oh, probably, yeah.
might be better if we don't mention that again. So this is in the podcasting application for iOS called Overcast, which is by Marco Arment, and he released it in mid-2014. And I'll put a link to the show notes, overcast.fm, if you want to take a look at it yourself. And so people were listening to our podcast in Overcast, and the first indication of a problem was in a tweet by Blake Winton on the 18th of November.
Mm-hmm.
And in part, he said, much earlier episodes are showing up recently. And we did look into this, and that does seem to be the case. Now, what I'm seeing when I look at it in the Overcast application is it always shows the latest episode, but then before that, it's like 18 or something. It's much earlier shows. Now, personally, I will admit, I didn't pay a whole lot of attention to this at first.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, well, if it's just a temporary glitch in Overcast, then it will fix itself. Or if we wait, we can see if there's a much more widespread problem. If there's something wrong with our feed
that
we need to fix, then we'll get reports from other people, and then we'll know we have to do something about it. And neither of those things happened. So the Overcast problem didn't go away by itself, and we didn't get any reports of problems from anybody else. Now, we did check our own feed, and we used the feedvalidator.org website to do that. Now, there were some minor problems, but nothing that should have caused this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Wolf was a bit more conscientious or fast-acting than I was in that he tweeted from the Edge Cases Twitter account to the Overcast Twitter account, so B2B2B2B, something like that, where you said, you know, our episodes are out of order, our feed is valid, a little help. Now, we didn't hear anything back. Now, there are a couple other people who also tweeted at the Overcast FM Twitter account, CCing us on it. And then I finally went ahead and emailed the feedback at overcast.fm on the 9th of December. We also didn't hear anything back. And we made some other overtures. And again, sort of nothing so far. Now, he says, specifically, Marco says on his website for the, when he says, well, here's the email address to email me. I will read and consider every tweet and email, but I can't respond to them all.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that he's not responding doesn't necessarily mean all that much. But it is still a problem, as far as we can tell. It's still an issue inside the Overcast application itself.
Right.
But I don't really take this personally. Like, if you do still feel the desire, any of our listeners do still feel the desire to contact Marco about this stuff, again, I would say, you know, don't take it personally. What I'm figuring is that this is primarily an issue of priorities. So there was a recent Overcast tweet from the Overcast Twitter account, Overcast FM. Overcast has just surpassed 200,000 users in less than 6 months. And I also, you know, he's also supporting a whole bunch of podcast feeds, which have many more users than we do. I think our user base is in the thousands at highest, whereas, you know, there are other podcasts like Serial or like This American Life or other things like that, which, you know, get hundreds of thousands or even millions of users. It's a one-man operation, and so, you know, can't necessarily respond to everything. I also think it's probably fairly likely that a lot of the feedback that he does get from people who have podcasts are from people whose podcast feeds are erroneous, that do have problems, and that's why they're breaking. So, kind of hard to read those out, to get, you know, and all of them, you know, I can imagine a lot of them saying, you know, ours is fine, ours is perfect, and it's not. So if he's going to make a policy of going through each of those by hand himself, he's probably going to have to go through a lot of them. So, as you know, I would say, you know, it's understandable that he didn't get to us. if you are going to contact him, you know, to keep it professional, I would say that we have given him enough information to know what to do if he decides to. So, you know, there's no sense in saying, well, you know, you didn't hear us. What, you know, didn't know. I'm sure the information has gotten through. And so, again, if you're going to do it yourself, I would keep that in mind, that probably the only way to change that would be if there were enough of us coming through to say, well, this really is a major problem. And I don't think there are enough of us to do that. So that's where I'm coming from. But the big reason why I'm not taking it personally, I'm not all that concerned, is that there is a workaround for what we do. So I want to talk about that for a few minutes. Mm-hmm. So our feed does validate, but that doesn't mean that there isn't something in our feed which makes Overcast kind of choke on it.
Mm-hmm.
So this got me back to what, you know, happens with everybody who's working on a problem. I have to debug it. And this brings me back to our episode, Playing Django with Microsoft Word, where I talked about sample projects for bug reports. This is episode 108. This is a lot like that, because I need to basically come up with the feed that demonstrates the problem. And, of course, the entire feed demonstrates the problem. What I decided to do was, well, I'll make a copy of our feed in preparation for doing the whole binary search thing. All right, cut it in half. And then if both things, you know, figure out which half has the problem, and then cut that in half, and then cut that in half, cut that in half, until the problem goes away, and then add everything back except the thing which seemed to cause the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, I'd isolate what's wrong, and we change that, and we'd be all set. What was the surprise for me was that the copy, with no changes to it, worked immediately.
Right.
No changes were necessary at all.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the original, the rss.xml, itself, if you type that in, that URL in to Overcast, and you can type in an entire URL instead of just searching his directory for things. If you type in our URL, or if you do the search, both of those things still fail. But if you type in our secondary URL, then it succeeds. And so that indicates to me that there's some sort of caching problem going on.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Because it's the same data.
Mm-hmm.
And what's also interesting, another data point, is that URL that you showed in the tweet, the one that's the website equivalent of the cached version of our podcast,
mm-hmm.
which is overcast.fm. There's no reason for me to say this, because you'll see by the end. overcast.fm/podcast/show/ bleh, like a whole bunch of, you know, numbers and letters, which mm-hmm. is a unique identifier for our podcast within his database. That works now, too, if you go to the website
right.
to do that. If you click on that link, and I'll put that link in the show notes.
Yeah, initially those were out of order.
Right, and now they work.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as you would hope, well, that means that maybe the caching is starting to work itself out.
Yep.
But no, it still doesn't work in the app. And what I do to test this is I'll subscribe to our feed, and then I'll delete it.
Yeah, me too.
And then I'll wait for a bit, and then I add it again. So it would seem that if it were just cached in the application, that would get rid of it, because it does take some time. It takes some seconds for the list of episodes to come in again. So I think it's some caching problem on the server.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know this, but that's what I suspect. And, you know, we're just going to kind of have to live with it. So it's also not really a big problem, because this secondary RSS URL that we have, you know, I'm not making that manually each time we update the main feed.
It's not handcrafted artisan RSS?
Well, Wolf, you made it. So, right? So it's some sort of redirect.
Yes. So essentially what it is, it's an Apache alias directive.
Yep.
Yeah. So it's bitwise identical to the other one.
Right. So it's not taking any extra effort on our part to maintain this.
Mm-hmm.
And so, we can maintain this indefinitely.
Yeah.
So, and that's where we're at right now. So what I figure is anyone who is a regular listener of the podcast is going to listen to this and know what the thing to do is. And again, I said it at the beginning. Let's say it again. Edgecasesshow.com/ where can I find it right now?
rss_overcast.xml.
And I decided to put the word overcast in there just to, as a bit of my own, eating my own dog food about maintenance. Like if I come back to this thing years and years later and I've completely forgotten about the Overcast thing, it'll say Overcast in it. That'll probably give me a little bit of data about that. So you should be, and you can, you know, take that URL, you type it in directly. Don't search on Edge Cases, type that URL in and you'll be fine. for now. If you don't do that, if you are someone who keeps track, if you're already up to date with the podcast, you always get the latest one at the top, it seems. And if there are some of you who are continuing to do that in Overcast, it would actually be kind of nice, because then you could tell us if and when it starts working again. I would be interested in hearing about that. And I suspect that eventually it will start working again, even if it's just through some sort of regular maintenance on the website. But we'll see. So that's pretty much where we're at as far as that's concerned. That's how we got to this point, and that's, you know, basically the only thing you really need to do if you want to keep using Overcast is use this alternate URL, and you should be all set. And I think that's pretty much all we're going to do at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's pretty much all we can do. Our feed is valid, right, and it's kind of out of our hands.
Yes. But, you know, I'm glad we do have a workaround. I'm glad you can keep listening to us. Overcast seems like a nice app. I mean, I don't use it myself. And Wolf, it doesn't sound like you.
Oh, no, it's my primary app.
It is.
I don't listen to our own episode, so.
That's right. Okay. Well, that works too, I suppose. And actually, that's true. I didn't subscribe to our feed myself either until recently, just to see what it was like. And it does, you know, like I looked at it in, what is the thing? Tweet. No, there's another RSS. All the new RSS stuff that came about after Google Reader. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems like our stuff works just fine in other places as well. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's where we're at. And again, any other problems, you know, let us know. The people letting us know through the Twitter account did seem to work quite nicely. So if you do have problems with other stuff, we can look into that as well. But this is the first time we've had any problems with an RSS reader in any way, or a podcast reader in any way. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that streak will continue.
Yeah.
And we'll see you next time.